Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the dilemma facing Democrats about how to react to Donald Trump's relentless barrage of insults and lies without stooping to Trump's level of gutter politics and hateful rhetoric. An historian of American political discourse, Jennifer Machia, a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, joins us. We'll discuss how much public shaming and protests against Sarah Sanders and Stephen Miller only serve to make these otherwise unsympathetic henchmen of Trump's sympathetic. And while Democrats are entitled to righteous anger at Trump's inhumanity and immorality, how do they avoid the trap of playing into Trump's hands by reacting in a way that Congresswoman Maxine Waters advocated, as opposed to following Michelle Obama's advice of when they go low, we go high? Then we'll speak with Nicholas Davis, a research scientist at the Public Policy Research Institute at Texas A&M, who is currently at work on a book about the popular meaning of democracy and is the co-author of a study, White Outgroup Intolerance and Declining Support for American Democracy. As the Republican Party moves from family values to white nationalism, we will explore the correlation between the intolerance of white Americans and their support for authoritarian rule, as intolerant white people appear to be abandoning their commitment to democracy while their perceptions are shaped by Trump and Fox News to believe that undeserving minorities are benefiting more from democracy than they are. Then finally, we'll go to Honduras and speak with Elizabeth Kennedy, an activist and scholar who focuses on the experience and needs of child, youth, and forced migrants and asylum seekers fleeing gang-related violence. We'll discuss what can be done to solve the immigration crisis on the U.S. southern border by dealing with the root causes of why migrants are fleeing Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, and El Salvador. Elizabeth calls for a need to address conditions of corruption and violence in these countries rather than have Trump score political points with absurd exaggerations that the MS-13 gang is taking over America when, in fact, it has all but taken over El Salvador. And joining us now, Jennifer Machia, who is a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric. An historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency, she's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Machia.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So, Jennifer, do you think that Donald Trump is deliberately furthering the polarization in this country and that, in effect, in doing so, he is setting a trap for the Democrats to abandon what Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high? You can see from what's going on with suggestions by Maxine Waters and the fact that the protests of at the restaurant where they kicked out Sarah Huckabee Sanders, you could argue that they're counterproductive and that they backfired and that they've actually made Sarah Huckabee Sanders a sympathetic figure, which is really saying something, given what the lies that she spews out on a daily basis to the press and the contempt with which she holds them. And, of course, now demonstrators are demonstrating at the home of Stephen Miller in Washington, D.C. And, again, if they can turn Stephen Miller into a sympathetic character, they are really achieving something, frankly. So I guess the bottom line question here is Trump setting a trap and are the Democrats falling into that trap?
Wow, there's a lot of assumptions there. Yeah, so I think that Trump is using polarizing rhetoric. He has been very successful in doing that. I don't know that he's doing that in order to set a trap for Democrats. I think what you see on the Democratic side is not necessarily party leaders, although you give the example of Maxine Waters, but more like Democratic Party members and activists taking direct action against people who they believe are complicit in what Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil. And so the idea with Hannah Arendt is that you know, a lot of people during Nazi Germany got away with doing things or made excuses for doing things because they said that was the law or that was policy, and they were just doing what they were supposed to. They were just following orders. And so it wasn't their fault. So when we look back on that time period, a lot of people say, well, they should have done something. They knew it was wrong. Why didn't they do something? And so what I think we see is these people who are protesting, the people who are complicit with the Trump administration, they're really trying to prevent what they see as the banality of evil. They see these people as cooperating in unjust actions and laws, and they're trying to make sure that they recognize what they're doing.
But doesn't it present the Democrats with a dilemma? That's, in fact, what's arguing between so-called establishment Democrats and insurgent Democrats. You know, we have a billionaire out here in California who's spending a lot of money calling for Trump's impeachment. And he's arguing that the Democrats have to go for the jugular and impeach Trump, whereas Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are saying, no, if you do that, you play right into the Republicans' hands, and we won't be able to win over moderate Republicans disaffected with Trump.
Sure. Well, so that's a partisan or an electoral calculus, right? So, you know, weighing options, good or bad, based on potential electoral outcomes. I think what we see happening with these direct confrontations is much more like a question of justice. Right. It's much more like a question of, you know, what can we do right at this moment to prevent what we see as a really unjust policy, right? Putting kids in prison, basically. And so maybe they're not really thinking about it in terms of an electoral consequence. You know, it's very reminiscent of honor culture. So, you know, societies of honor regulate behavior based on shaming people, public shaming. You know, and so if you think back in American history, something like tarring and feathering someone who didn't adhere to the importation, non-importation resolve, right? So someone who, for example, consumed tea when it wasn't, you know, allowed to do that in the U.S. or in the colonies, you know, they would be tarred and feathered. And some people would call that terrorism, right? You take somebody out of their home and you parade them around town, and you put boiling hot tar on them and feathers, and you leave them, you know, exposed to public ridicule. You know, it's a kind of direct action and public shaming, but it's meant to send a message.
Right. But you are going down that road of witch burning, aren't you, though?
It could be. So that's a sort of different situation, because those were people, elite leaders, who were accusing other people of being witches.
Right.
So it's a difference of whether it comes from, you know, sort of the grassroots or whether it comes from the leadership. And that's one of the differences I've seen in political discourse in the last few years, is that, you know, the question of civility and incivility is typically... incivility is the last resort of the desperate, of the oppressed, of the people who have no voice, who have no countenance or ability to access the public stage, right? And so we usually give a lot of latitude to incivility, because when people use it, they're usually the powerless, and we should hear their voices. But over the past 3 years, ever since Trump launched his campaign, we've seen incivility being used by people in power, by leadership. We don't typically see that in elected officials. And at the same time, you've seen Donald Trump and his allies claim to be victims, right? There's this massive oppression of their voice by the fake news, by a conspiracy, by, you know, whoever. It doesn't matter. They'll come up with somebody, because that's been their way of positioning themselves. And so it gives them this sort of just cause for speaking in uncivil and acting in uncivil ways. Now, that's really unusual in American political discourse. We haven't seen a lot of that in the past. I can't think of an analog even.
And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. But isn't that the real sort of dilemma here? And I don't want to reduce or in any way belittle the righteous passion of people who are absolutely outraged by the behavior of Trump and Sessions and Stephen Miller and General Kelly in deliberately taking children from their parents at the border. That is both inhumane and immoral, and there's no getting around it, and they don't deserve a free pass ever. And you have to salute people who are genuinely outraged at this inhumanity and this immorality. But at the same time, when you have a celebrity like Robert De Niro just dropping an F-bomb at the Tonys, at least had he sort of contextualized a little bit and not played into Trump's hands by making Trump and his people the victim, instead by at least prefacing, saying, you know, Donald Trump has lowered presidential rhetoric to the gutter at a historically low, and I guess I feel free now to speak in a language that he understands, and then he could have dropped the F-bomb. Would that have helped, do you think?
he could have, yeah. I don't know what Robert De Niro was thinking, but, you know, so I think that in a polarized context like the one that we have now, there are very strong feelings, obviously, on both sides. And you're right, you know, one side is always going to point to whatever the other side does, and they're going to say that's wrong, that's immoral, that's not okay, even if they do those same things, right? So if you ever read Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, he talks about the ethics of means and ends, and that's one of his 10 points that he makes, or 13 points that he makes, is that, you know, you always claim that the tactics of the other side are unmoral and unjust. So, yeah, in this instance, I think probably using bad words and being mean, gives the other side ammunition. But I think that anything that one side did, the other side would use as ammunition. So it's hard to judge.
Right. But you can go back to George Bernard Shaw's advice. I learned long ago never to wrestle with a pig. You get dirty. And besides, the pig likes it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so I guess, you know, as someone who studies political discourse in this country, the thing that I'm really interested in thinking about is how are we solving political problems, and does the language we use help us to solve problems or prevent us from solving problems? And I think there's a strong case to be made that it doesn't help us to solve political problems when we call each other names and we use bad words. And I think that in that sense, it makes it very difficult for us to transcend these, you know, partisan differences and find common ground. And finding common ground is necessary to solve problems. So, you know, did De Niro solve any problems by what he did? No. Did he help us? Probably not. So, you know, I think by that metric, you could definitely sort of condemn that behavior.
Well, but again, I think one of the reasons why people who are angry at Trump and angry at what he's done in the name of the American people, that's both inhumane and immoral, have every right to protest. And I think a lot of it's happening in the absence of the Democratic establishment, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, actually standing up to Trump. I mean, he's been saying lately the most outrageous lies, that the Democrats want to let MS-13 gang members into this country so that they could vote Democratic, that the Democrats are to blame for what's going on the border. And he just absolutely outrageously lies. And you don't hear a damn thing from Schumer or Pelosi. It's the same thing that happened back when John Kerry was running against George W. Bush. Karl Rove took away Kerry's greatest strength, which was that he was a Vietnam War hero, and they manufactured this Swift Boat for Truth group who took away Kerry's greatest asset, and he didn't fight back. And my understanding is, you know, if you go back to the sort of Confederacy and the gentleman like in Gone with the Wind, Ashley, a gentleman who is insulted is expected to stand up for himself. And I just get a feeling that the Democratic Party, its leadership is simply not standing up for themselves in the face of outrageous charges, and they're not standing up for the truth.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. And I bet those people who are directly confronting the people of the Trump administration probably agree with that. I mean, I think that that's part of what is motivating people, is that they're frustrated with the leadership of their own party as much as they're frustrated with anybody else.
So given that the mainstream media, the very people that Trump attacks, and then Jim Acosta was attacked at a rally, and the CNN broadcaster at a rally in South Carolina, a Trump rally, and they were jeering him while he was doing his live shots, the hostility towards the press is absolutely palpable. But it was ginned up during the campaign by Donald Trump at his rallies. And believe it or not, while Trump was attacking the press, what did the Main Street press do? They gave Trump about $5 to $6 billion worth of free advertising.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. You know, it's one of the ironies, I think, of the last few years, is that Trump has been able to take advantage of the weakness of the news industry, right? And so because people have been so interested in finding out what he's going to do, and he says all these inflammatory things, and it's really odd and gets your attention and has everyone on edge, you know, everyone is so interested. And so they just run Trump stories all the time. You know, I've spoken with a lot of journalists who feel the pressure of their editors, you know, for metrics and analytics, and they're tired of covering Trump. They'd rather not. You know, they know that there's an effect to the fact that they're giving him so much attention. But at the same time, they're being told, you know, he brings in dollars. He even said not too long ago, he even said that the press is going to have to start being nicer to me because they need me to win in 2020 so that they can keep getting their advertising. I don't know that that's all that wrong, to be honest.
Oh, in the broader sense, it's wrong, but it's not inaccurate.
Yeah, exactly, not inaccurate.
So then what do you think, is there a way then for Schumer and Pelosi to sort of stand up? And if they're so worried that the mob is going to play into Trump's hands, why don't they start coming up with a narrative? I mean, he's going to win in 2020, and perhaps the Republicans might even avoid a defeat in 2018, because there is no narrative. It seems like the Democratic establishment is so afraid of their own base that they are running away from it. And it's true, on the one hand, if your only platform is impeachment, that's not a winning issue, but it is a way to placate your angry base. But is there a more strategic and useful way to placate the angry Democratic base?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is right. I think that it hasn't yet become clear who is the new leader of the Democratic Party and what the narrative is. It does seem like anti-Trump is the mandate from the base, like you say, but it isn't clear who's in charge or what the story is. And it's very difficult to rein in all the different parts of the base. It seems to me like people are really energized. They want to, you know, defend what they think of as democratic norms and policies. And I don't know who we're supposed to look to, or who they're supposed to look to.
Right, but traditionally, the deficit on the part of the Democrats, and particularly in midterms, Obama himself said that there's almost a genetic problem that the Democrats have, that they don't vote in midterms, whereas the Republicans are much, much more motivated. And they're always motivated in elections. Republicans get every last one of their voters out. But the Democrats always have a problem inspiring their natural majority, if you will, even though there are more independents now in America than there are both Democrats and I think Democrats are still slightly ahead of independents, and Republicans are in third place, numerically speaking. But still, that's always been their problem, inspiring their people to come out. So it would seem that you've got that going for you this time around, don't you? People are angry and they're inspired and they're active. So you can't step on that, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, so political scientists and people who've been carefully monitoring these primary turnouts, you know, and special election turnouts since Trump was elected, have been trying to predict what's going to happen in 2018, and they keep going back and forth. I think it's really difficult to tell. You know, I think that sometimes they're predicting a blue wave and sometimes they're predicting a red wave. I think that one of the reasons why Trump is out there doing so many rallies, and he said that he's going to continue to do them throughout till November, is because, again, he gets a lot of airtime for doing them. He gets his message out directly, and he generates a lot of buzz and excitement. So he's using his rallies to be able to try to win the election in November. We'll see how that works. I think that's a much more active strategy than we saw Obama doing during his two midterms. So, you know, we'll see if that works for him.
Well, Jennifer Machir, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your expertise on this subject of presidential rhetoric, which I think, in all fairness and objectivity, being fair and balanced as I am, is there's no question that I believe, and I'd like your final opinion on that, that presidential rhetoric under Donald Trump is sunk to an all-time low.
Unequivocally, yes.
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Machir, a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. And she's finishing a third book about Donald Trump's presidential campaign and demagoguery. We can take a brief station break and back looking into how the Republican Party is moving from family values to white nationalism.
And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame, and the poor white remains on the caboose of the train. But it ain't him to blame, he's only a pawn in our game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nicholas Davis, a research scientist at the Public Policy Research Institute at Texas A&M University and a lecturer at the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. He is currently at work on a book about the popular meaning of democracy, and he is the co-author of a recent study, White Outgroup Intolerance and Declining Support for American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Davis.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And Nicholas, your study finds that there's a correlation between the increasing intolerance of white Americans and the support for authoritarian rule. In other words, when intolerant white people are afraid of that a democracy will benefit minorities in particular, they abandon their commitments to democracy. So, in other words, is the Republican Party moving away from family values to white nationalism?
So we can trace this back in the survey data to the mid-90s. And what we found, you know, pretty early on when we had the available survey data was that the percentage of people espousing outgroup intolerance was relatively modest. It was really around 10 to 12%. And the most recent survey we've got from 2011 suggests that it's increased about a quarter. And so we don't have the most recent wave of the World Value Surveys to see whether or not this has increased even further. But if that trend extrapolated out to 2017, then we would expect to see something like one in three people. And so that's actually pretty worrisome. And so whether or not that characterizes mainstream Republicans, I'm not sure. Certainly when we talk about the correlation between conservatism and social intolerance, that is relatively high. But whether or not we're talking about Republicans as mainstream, it's not abundantly clear, but that distinction may be less interesting insofar as it does seem like a certain subsect of Republicans have sort of co-opted the party from its kind of traditional mainstream family values and really pushed it right on matters of race generally and more recently immigration specifically.
Well, there's nothing more stark in terms of family values and upholding them than having children ripped from their parents at the southern border. And while it obviously has maintained enormous support for Donald Trump, and he believes, I think the reason he's making an issue out of the border is that he's doing well by it with his base and riling them up. But in the case of the children being ripped from their parents, at least some of the religious right leaders who've unswervingly supported him, like Franklin Graham, did at least utter some criticism, did they not?
That's right, they did. And so I think you see something of a break in at least very recently with evangelicals stepping in and saying, maybe this isn't okay. Maybe we should seek to keep children with their mothers. But what's curious is you don't necessarily see them making the distinction regarding how these people are treated as it's related to being rounded up through ports of entry, right? And so it seems like out of one side of the mouth you get we should keep families together as they're processed through the legal channels. But there, it does seem like at least the underlying kind of identity-driven appeals that Trump is making regarding non-white individuals, right? So immigrants. It does seem to play well with this group of people. So it really is a delicate dance, I think, that there's a very fine line that these religious leaders are walking, because I do think they sense that this is not okay, and I do think they are getting pushback from their congregations. But that kind of runs headlong into the idea that what it means to be an American is to keep others who are not Americans out if they're willing to come via channels that they consider are inappropriate or not legal.
Well, in that regard, the president was just handed a gift from the Supreme Court, and he's extremely pleased with the ruling upholding his Muslim travel ban, and it now means that people from Muslim-majority countries like Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen can't come in, of course, as well as North Korean and Venezuelan. But there again, it would seem that the court is strengthening Trump's hand. And since apparently the law, United States Code, USC 1182F, apparently is bolstered by this ruling, and it essentially gives President Trump not just latitude in banning Muslims, but also cracking down further on the border, which I think we can expect. So it seems like the five conservative justices on the Supreme Court, would you categorize them as drifting away from family values towards white identity politics?
Well, so I'm not a judicial scholar, but I do think that it does kind of play into the burbling narrative that that the United States needs to be very careful about outsiders, right? And so that ruling does sort of strengthen Donald Trump's hand to say, the idea that America first is what we should be pursuing is not only supported by my supporters, right, but look at these justices have handed down a ruling that really does support what I'm trying to do. And what he's going to end up doing is conflating. So the justices are going to argue that what they're doing is just interpreting the law. Donald Trump will interpret that as, well, they're actually tacitly supporting my policy initiatives, right? And so there is some, those two things are subtly different. But I think you're right that this does sort of play into Donald Trump's general rhetoric that we should be excluding these types of individuals from the United States simply by virtue of their country of origin.
Yes, so Chief Justice Roberts, in handing down the opinion, said the travel ban was squarely within the scope of presidential authority. Mm-hmm. But clearly, and while it's probably right for them to reject the idea that what he said on the stump isn't necessarily relevant to what he's done as president. On the other hand, there's no consistency in this Muslim travel ban. Saudi Arabia, which is responsible for, 15 of the 19 hijackers in 9/11, they get a free pass, you know.
Right.
So what's going on there? And they're the ones that have been spreading a very hot anti-Western version of Islam for decades now.
Yeah, well, so I think part of what's going on is that there's some indiscriminacy regarding who this applies to. And Trump is not necessarily one who thinks with a clear logic, I think, regarding connecting the dots on this sort of stuff. And so I frankly, as an American, as my purview is mostly American democracy. So I'm not sure the justification for why some countries and not others. But I do think it sort of points back to a curious inconsistency that that the administration is sort of willing to willy-nilly apply these sorts of rules to countries that they just perceive to either be amenable to U.S. interests or to be hostile based on, you know, things that are totally out of the control of folks from those countries.
So let's focus in on how the Republican Party has become the Trump Party. That's what John Boehner recently said, and I think it's pretty clear. Mm-hmm. And that essentially the choice between bigotry and democracy is at stake here, and it seems to be that Donald Trump is enabling the first while abandoning the second. Our previous guest, Jennifer Machia, who is at Texas A&M University, she's an historian of presidential rhetoric. I asked her about whether or not it's a deliberate tactic on Donald Trump's part to further polarize an already polarized and tribal country, which is what he appears to do, and the extent to which he's also setting a trap for Democrats to reciprocate and abandon the advice given by former First Lady Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high. Do you think that's at play here?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think he wants to set up as many tricky traps as he can to get involved in spats that have little to do with the popular issues of the day, right? So he's going to pounce on, you know, Maxine Waters, he's going to pounce on her rhetoric. He's going to ignore the substance of what she's saying and try to portray this as see what the Democrats are doing. And I think he's looking for any chance he can get to make this about kind of cheap points to take people away from the real difficult subject matter of children being separated from parents at the border, right? And so the more he can do to, I mean, the fact of the matter is the United States is a country that has laws, right? And so anything that he can do to try to push Democrats into a corner, he wants to make this a very easy decision for people who are amenable to his vision of America. He wants to make Democrats seem lawless. He wants to make them seem like they don't have the interests of the country at heart. And so anything he can do to simplify and really distill politics down to sort of a guttural kind of racial identity, right? A national identity. Anything he can do to distill political debate down to those terms is just going to trigger and play right into his hand. And his supporters, they seem to really feed off that. And so I think the Democrats are going to have a hard time combating that on those terms, because there just doesn't seem to be a shared consensus about, in some sense, American values, right? Because the idea of tolerance is really baked into the idea of democracy. And so given that there seems to be no real agreement on what constitutes appropriate levels of tolerance towards others, I think that he's playing the right hand as it relates to his end game.
Well, but he's also, is he not, signaling that he's actually said this many times, effectively, that the Democrats don't care about white Americans, they only care about minorities. And that's the cleavage that he's exploiting, is he not? Somebody said
he's
that
just sticking his thumb right in it.
Right, that somebody said that demographics are destiny. But many, both Trump and his supporters, are kind of like King Canute, trying to stop the tide, the demographic inevitability that whites will become a minority in this country. What I find extraordinary is that in the face of the relentless insults against Mexicans and the treatment currently going on the border, which is absolutely inhumane and immoral, there's no evidence that there's a huge uptick in Latino voting. So Trump may win in 2018 and 2020. His people are fired up and ready to vote, but it doesn't appear that the people he's insulting are necessarily going to step up and fight back.
That's right. I mean, when you look at the correlates of you know, vote intention and then voter turnout, white people turn out at much higher rates oftentimes than in people of color. And so whether he triggers a backlash, it doesn't necessarily seem that for all of his rhetoric that he's going to pay an electoral price as it relates to compelling different blocks of people from turning out to vote. The parties have had an awkward relationship with Latino voters for the last eight to 12 years. And so neither party seems to make inroads like the Democratic Party has with African Americans. Right. If Trump can manage to thread this needle and use this vernacular of exclusion and encourage his white supporters to come out and vote without triggering a compensatory wave of individuals who are of, you know, Latino background to come out and vote for Democrats, then yeah, I think it's highly likely that he walks away without a huge electoral penalty.
And since you and your co-author, Stephen Miller, Nicholas Davis, the information you used for your new report, Whiteout Group Intolerance and Declining Support for American Democracy, comes from the World Values Survey, can we sort of try and sort of figure out to my mind, the progenitor of much of this is Vladimir Putin in Russia. And people like Stephen Bannon admire, and I think Trump does too, certainly admires Putin, we're not sure why. In Bannon's case, he made it clear that Putin is a champion of Christian values and white nationalism, and he's standing up against the tide, he's against homosexuals, he's against European liberalism, and he's managed to project those values, if that's the right way to put it, into Hungary and Poland and now Austria and a number of Western Europeans with countries like Germany with the AfD are heading in this path. What is that peculiar political correlation between white nationalism, anti-immigrant feelings, and creeping fascism?
Well, I think at its core, it's a desire for homogenization. I think it's we see these trends. You're right. We see these trends across Europe. We see them in Russia, and they do seem to be spreading. To some extent, the National Front, right, in France, made the presidential runoff. UKIP was largely fueled by some of the same anti-immigrant sentiments that we see popping up in the United States. And so
they succeeded with Brexit, right? I mean,
that's right.
Brexit
that's right.
was all about and white nationalism and exclusion of the other.
That's right. And so, you know, we do see these movements popping up. And I think that's why, you know, books like How Democracies Die are vital in the moment, because they are giving some kind of cross-national context to what to expect when these things happen. In some of these countries, the underlying institutional structure makes it a little bit easier for, far-right populist parties to gain traction. You know, in the United States, it does seem like a segment of Republicans have sort of captured and co-opted the party. I do think that there is enough soft pushback from Republicans that this probably, yeah, I have to hedge, it probably won't go quite as far as it has in other countries. But I think that's certainly the real danger. I think you've definitely tapped into something that certainly political scientists are still trying to understand.
And I forget to mention in that list of Eastern European and Western European countries that Italy has now just turned to the far right, and the new interior ministry is apparently the power behind the throne, Salvini. His mentor is Stephen Bannon, and he's totally in that category. So it is quite evident what's happening. But when you talk about moderate Republicans pushing back, the only ones that are standing up to Trump are all resigning.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
Right.
So the counter argument that to my statement that you think moderate Republicans will do something is that you're right. It does seem like many of these individuals who have provided some amount of friction to Trump are all disinclined to continue participating in politics. And so it has opened up, I think, the opportunity for Democrats to be perhaps a little more electorally successful in the fall. It certainly has increased their chances to take back some seats. But as far as intra-party, within the party moderation, you just don't see it yet. And whether or not we see it, I'm sure is something of an open question. I think that's right.
So is it all sort of, does it all go back to the idea that the Democrats had the Dixiecrats, and the minute the civil rights happened in this country with the Voting Rights Act, which the Supreme Court just yesterday eviscerated?
That's right.
And I think in many ways, I think that's the key, at least to what we were talking about, what Jennifer Machio about, was when Mitch McConnell refused to allow even a hearing for Merrick Garland. And for reasons I don't understand, Obama basically was defeated. I don't know why he couldn't have fought back more, but that was a key moment, and it's all been downhill since then. And now you can see that having Neil Gorsuch on the court has made all the difference. The rulings that we talked about today and we talked about yesterday with today's upholding of the Muslim ban, they wouldn't have happened without Gorsuch. So that seems to be the sort of lesson here. And doesn't that play into that old adage, nice guys finish last?
I think so. You know, and I think looking back, Democrats will think that it was a calculated mistake not to harp on the presidential election in 2016 as a referendum on the Supreme Court. I mean, certainly conservatives were willing to make that case, and they made it openly. I think Democrats were sensitive of it, but I don't know that they necessarily ran on that as a pillar of their platform. You know, you said something interesting about Dixiecrats and how, you know, we see the sorting out of conservatives to the Republican Party and liberals to the Democratic Party really happen in earnest after the Civil Rights Act. And one of the things that never went away, while it might have remained a bit more latent under the surface, was racial animosity. The history of the United States is one in which race has been the defining cleavage of both partisan politics, but also economics and across a variety of domains. And even though the Civil Rights Act passes, these things don't just go away. They're institutionalized. And so I think what you're seeing now is sort of I don't want to call it the final manifestation, but the eventual manifestation of a lot of burbling tensions that have just been sitting latent since this sorting out of conservatives to the Republican Party and liberals to the Democratic Party. And in some sense, this sorting out has got us to where we are today, in that we see that there's not only kind of an ideological sorting, but it's almost something of a racial sorting as well. And so this was almost always going to have happened, right? Like, hindsight's 20/20. But certainly the tensions that give us this sort of nativist, racially resentful party, these things have certainly existed in the rhetoric of politicians all across the South for the last 50 years.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nicholas Davis.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Davis, who's a research scientist at the Public Policy Research Institute at Texas A&M University and a lecturer in the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. He is currently at work on a book about the popular meaning of democracy, and he is the co-author of a recent study, White Outgroup Intolerance and Declining Support for American Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and back and look into the root causes of why migrants are fleeing Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, and El Salvador.
Politics needs human beings. Politics needs lives.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Elizabeth Kennedy, who's a social scientist doing research with children and families in Honduras and El Salvador that has been widely used in asylum claims. And currently, she's a consultant with the Norwegian Refugee Council's Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Kennedy.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Elizabeth, I'm operating on the assumption, in fact, it was expressed by the former head of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, who said recently in a television interview that for all of Donald Trump's toughness and making this so-called tough stand on the border, ripping children from their parents, etc., and he keeps referring to being tough, 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 and the Democrats are weak. But for all of that macho rhetoric, at the end of the day, nothing that Trump does will solve this problem unless you direct its root causes and start to deal with conditions in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico. I take it that you believe that to be the case.
Yes, it's definitely important to address the conditions in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras so that those who are born here and have their families and homes here can stay. For me, I've been working on this topic, doing research with children and families for almost a decade now. And I know children and families who live in the United States, in addition to other countries outside of where they were born and built their homes. If they could return home and be safe, they would do so. Unfortunately, they cannot. And this causes them a great deal of pain. So the focus should be on helping to create the conditions so that people don't have to flee their homes. No one ever wants to be in a position where they have to do that.
Well, it seems, though, that Donald Trump is more intent on scoring political points with his absurd exaggerations that the MS-13 street gangs are taking over America, when in fact, as far as I can tell, they've all but taken over El Salvador.
Right. Well, Trump has had an interesting focus on the gang MS-13. The gang MS-13 was created in the United States and was exported or deported to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala in the late 1990s as a result of changes in our immigration law, reforms in 1996 specifically. Those countries, particularly Guatemala and El Salvador, had just ended decades-long civil war, were more or less destroyed, had a number of children, families, and communities suffering from trauma that had taken place over years, lost families, lost wages, no infrastructure. So it was a perfect storm. Gangs were able to take root, and we're talking about membership in the tens of thousands in the region, whereas in the United States, it's estimated that there's a population of 10,000. Whether it's the United States, El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras, though, if you truly want to get rid of gangs, then you need to focus on the problems of poverty. You know, the young people that end up in gangs are from the poorest communities where they don't have access to educational and economic opportunities. They often suffer abuse in the home and in the streets. They are lacking protection from the state, from their family, from their schools. They face stigma and are treated poorly because of where they're from, how they dress, what they don't have. If we really want gangs not to be able to recruit or to thrive, then we should instead offer loving and caring communities to these young people so that they're able to turn to those persons and those organizations instead for protection and belonging.
And apart from, say, the Catholic Church, are there any state organizations that offer those services?
Unfortunately, state organizations tend to be focused on security-based solutions, so trying to crack down or imprison youth from these neighborhoods. Typically, they are brown-skinned and black-skinned, and the United States, just as is the case in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, has rather discriminatory practices towards these youth and their communities. They've focused a lot more on practices that further entrench gangs instead of allowing these communities to build themselves up, to establish trust with each other. And I mean, one of the most important things here is also addressing, you know, generational trauma. different crises and abuses that have been suffered over time and throughout generations. Learning how to react to those situations differently is very difficult, especially without the tools necessary to do that. And so instead, programs should be focused on that. There are a number of communities that have such nonprofit organizations doing just this, but the state itself, unless we're talking about a handful of states in the United States, don't tend to take those approaches.
Well, Donald Trump, of course, is militarizing the border and wants to build a wall. And now huge amounts of money are going to ICE and Border Patrol, and also huge amounts of money are going into building these prisons that they're going to house these families in, assuming that they can find children and the parents and reunite them. So a lot of money is being spent at this end. Could that money be spent in countries like where you are in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala and Mexico in terms of foreign aid? In other words, would it be cheaper for the U.S. to address the problems that you're talking about rather than try and cope with the consequences here on our southern border?
This is a big question because obviously money can always be put to a different and better use that could likely have the type of impact that most of us in society desire. However, there's always vested interest involved with money and who gets it. In the region of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, it's very difficult for community-based organizations to get their hands on the foreign aid that arrives. Because of changes that were made during the Bush administration, I believe organizations abroad now have to have an operating budget of almost $1 million or more annually. So what that means is that you get international organizations who get the original contract and then subcontract out, sometimes two levels down. So whereas that international organization will get $2 or $3 million from U.S. foreign aid, the actual community-based organization that does the day-to-day work and knows the context on the ground will end up with $10,000 or so. So I think one big question we need to be having is how foreign aid is allocated, particularly to grassroots organizations and community organizations. The other problem is that even in the region, the majority of the funding that arrives is security-based. So that type of community programming or nonviolence programming often gets tied up and doesn't arrive in the same amounts that were promised, whereas money for weapons, for military equipment, does always manage to make its way into the hands of what we know are corrupt military and police.
Well, we're certainly turning a blind eye to the leader of Honduras and the people in his government who have ties to drug traffickers, same in Guatemala, which is a sort of narco-democracy, and in Nicaragua, which has been fairly stable and hasn't had a huge outflow. Now you have a dictatorial government shooting its own people in the streets in order to cling onto power. So you could have another wave coming from Nicaragua to add to the waves from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. So surely, I mean, is there anything that the U.S. can do? There's going to be a change of government in Mexico with López Obrador being, I think, less sympathetic to Trump than probably any Mexican president in history. What do you think about the idea of better governance and better leadership in these countries?
Well, one thing I've always thought in the region is that, for example, Mexico has a lot, in some ways, has a lot more in common with El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras than with the United States. And to the extent that El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras are going to be able to apply adequate pressure to tell the United States no to certain items or to better advocate for their citizens outside of their countries of origin, they probably do need an ally like Mexico. And Mexico could benefit from that alliance as well. You know, part of the problem is that historically, the money and choices that the United States has made in the region have further strengthened corrupt entities, have fortified or overlooked abuses of human rights, and have focused more than anything on economic interest and maintaining a very limited, powerful economic elite. the United States needs to reevaluate that, because as long as you allow large portions of society to live in extreme poverty, a type of poverty that most in the United States don't know and cannot comprehend, those conditions are never good conditions. Desperate people will do desperate things, and it would be much better to provide and to encourage countries to provide for their citizens a basic standard of living, and also provide all young people with the opportunities to maximize their potential, because that ultimately benefits everyone in society, not just the child and his or her family.
So obviously that's a heavy lift in terms of finding ways to improve the economies of these countries. But given the tradition and the history of inequality, which, by the way, we have here in this country, and it's growing, I'm not sure, you know, how we are necessarily setting the example, but is there any indication of a way that you would see, since you work in these countries, that you could start addressing poverty without addressing economic inequality and bad governance?
Yes, and I think you hit the nail on the head. The United States struggles with these problems as well. And in this sense, we are exporting our weaknesses and requiring that other countries adapt them as their own. The United States also, there are some exceptions when you start looking into differences between the 50 states, but the United States also has a heavy concentration of resources in its elite and has a deteriorating education system, a deteriorating health system, and doesn't particularly put a lot of focus, care, or concern on providing a strong social safety net. In this regard, the United States likely won't be the example. You might want to see the Nordic countries, for example, providing their know-how and expertise on what that could look like in the region. And this may be one of the side effects of the U.S. losing power and standing internationally, that other countries could have more of an influence in what has typically been a stronghold for the United States foreign policy and interest.
Well, but most of America's foreign aid, the biggest recipient of America's foreign aid is Israel. And I think Egypt is second. So that they take up the lion's share. So I don't know where you find a constituency for Central America and Mexico, except they happen to be our neighbors. You would think that that would be where our focus is on our own neighborhood. But curiously enough, our foreign policy focus appears to be elsewhere.
Definitely. And obviously my expertise is in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, but the United States certainly sends a large amount of primarily military aid to other parts of the world and has equally problematic relationships in doing so and document human rights abuses. I'm not advocating that the United States not invest in the region. I have long thought that the United States should evaluate how it invests in the region, because there's historical precedent and ongoing precedent that they don't necessarily do so in the way that's truly going to create change, and change is very much needed.
Well, Elizabeth Kennedy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Likewise, thank you again for having me.
And I've been speaking with Elizabeth Kennedy, who is a social scientist doing research with children and families in Honduras and El Salvador that has been widely used in asylum claims. And currently she's a consultant with the Norwegian Refugee Council's Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.